We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots Podcast. It's all Pelicans, all the time. And welcome to the podcast. Been a little while since we recorded one, since we had all the holidays in the middle. The Pelicans gave us the wonderful treat of going 3-3 since our last podcast, where they won three in a row, got everybody's hopes up, made everybody feel pretty good, and then decided to crap the bed versus Dallas and the New York Knicks. So, Michael, which team is it? Who are these guys? Are they anybody? Do they not know what they are? How can they look so different from game to game?
Because it was 2017. Now that it's 2018, they're going to completely change. They're finally going to live up to all their potential, and we won't have this back and forth 500 garbage. So just put that in the past. 2018 is going to be a whole new organization.
Optimism from Michael McNamara.
Yeah.
That just gives us January 1st.
Yeah, that was sarcasm. But yeah. We've been gone for six games. They go 3-3. Like, we're really not needed here. We could do the podcast today for the rest of the year. Let's just look at how many games are in the week. Say that they were 500, lament over all the games that they blew, and just pack it up and call it a day for this 41-win team.
23-23 the rest of the way. We're calling it here.
Yeah, I could see the ones are going to win and lose, win, loss, loss, win, loss. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we could call it right now. But, no, it's frustrating because, you know, luckily I've been around long enough to where I don't get my hopes up anymore, but I feel bad for, like, the newbie Pelicans fan. They have two impressive wins. Actually, I would say three in a row against Orlando, Miami, and Brooklyn, where at, you know, some point they just stepped on a team's throat, got up by almost 30 in some games, more than 30 in the Brooklyn game, and it just, like, okay, you know, we heard all this rhetoric about AD saying they switch things up in practice, and you know, now that they're really focused, and you look at the schedule and you got Dallas and New York coming up, Utah who's still without Gobert, like you start thinking six game win streak, seven, eight, and then of course at home they crap the bed against Dallas, who's at the time the worst team in the league or second worst. And the New York Knicks, who are one of the worst road teams in the NBA, playing their third game in four nights. So that's the Pelicans for you.
Well, so New York. So let me talk about that New York thing for a second.
they, like when we played them, the Pelicans were 18-17 and New York were 17-18.
Yeah, but do you know what their road record is?
No.
Yeah, I mean, so
it doesn't matter. They're an average team. It's not that.
They were the second worst team on the road in the NBA. But okay, yeah, they're an average team, but they're great at home and terrible on the road. And again, playing their third game in four nights, but you could let it slide. That's fine.
Yeah. and Dallas is on a four-game winning streak now.
Yeah.
They have the longest winning streak in the league at the moment.
Yeah, no, they're playing hard, and I mean, they just hit an insane amount of shots. Like, you leave teams open, and they're not going to hit as many threes as Dallas if you just walk off.
They were 16 of 23 at one point.
Yeah.
It's like from three, 16 of 23. Like, I can kill the Pelicans because they started the game stupid with some turnovers. They didn't, like, do everything they needed to. But, you know, at some point, 16 of 23, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah, now that one doesn't bother me as much because, of course, the schedule makers, like, they don't give us Memphis when they're terrible or the Rockets when they're terrible. They give us Orlando when they're playing great, Dallas when they're playing the greatest stretch of their season, whatever. So you just kind of roll your eyes at that one and shrug your shoulders. But the Knicks one is just that one on so many levels was, you know, insane to me. I mean, you're up 99-91 with less than 3 minutes left. That one felt a lot like the Sacramento game where, again, you had an inferior team ready to lie down. All you got to do is put your foot on their throat, and instead you do stupid stuff. You go back to the ISO that you and I both hate. That one is the one that's far more frustrating to me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it really annoyed me that in general, I actually like the switching schemes that the Pelicans do. They switch everything on the wing. You'll watch, you know, if a guard is coming from the corner out to the middle of the floor, the two wing players will just switch the player that they're guarding and stay basically in the same area. It's easier. There's less confusion generally. But in this game, the Knicks were just basically running that side pick and roll to get Porzingis stuck on any small guy they wanted to, and the Pelicans just let them do that. They never, ever switched up the fact that they were doing switches on that, and it murdered them. Drew got three fouls really quick because of it, and it never really worked out that well. But let's talk that final play. I wanted you to get your take on the final play, because I know a lot of people were very upset about how, you know, oh, a three for Davis? This is terrible, Gentry. You should be fired. So, was that a play call to generate a three for Davis, or was it something else?
So, I mean, it looked like it was for Miller, and then Davis said that he had a couple of options there, and when he saw the guys go with Miller, he drifted by in the three-point line, and it came up a little short. To me, my issue is I saw a lot of people say, you take the two there and you go to overtime at home. Like a locked-in team is just going to give you an easy two. Like any two-point play you draw up is just going to be easy and automatic. That's the funny part to me. I mean, you quote-unquote go for the two there. You probably hit it 45% of the time, at which you go to overtime, and let's say you win 60% of the time in overtime. I'm not great at stats, but to me that's, you know, a less than 40% probability of winning that game. And I think Davis hits that shot 40 out of 100 times, and, you know, I'm fine with that. But the overall point is anybody who looks at the last play of the game and puts 80% of their, you know, their attention and their talking on that is just missing the bigger picture. Again, it's 99-91 with less than 3 minutes left. They do a pick and roll, and Boogie just watches Noah dunk the ball because we're up eight, so it doesn't matter. We've already won. We're not locked in. And then the next play, to me, changed the entire game. Rondo had been great with the ball all night and all week, just throws it inexplicably right into the Knicks' hands. Jarrett Jack comes down and hits a transition three. Like, to me, that's what people should be talking about. Porzingis getting the offensive rebound when the Pels could have closed it out and then hitting that three. Like, those are much bigger plays than Anthony Davis missing a wide open three. But that's the one everybody's going to talk about just because it came at the end of the game.
Yeah. And honestly, I when I saw the play, it was it looked like an elevator door play for Darius Miller, which I thought awesome that that was like their first option was get their three-point shooter an open look. And he made a brilliant read there because he went through the door, the guy made it through after him, and instead of like just throwing the ball back, he actually dribbled to the middle of the floor to create some room, looked around, found Davis wide open, and hit him. Like, this is exactly what you want your team to do. Like, he looked around. He picked the appropriate basketball play. So, it's kind of frustrating. I wanna jump on Mr. Rondo for a second, though, because he had this during the span, he had the 25-assist game, which, by the way, as much as anybody else, I was giggling and laughing during that, watching the fourth quarter, as he just dramatically looked for assists in every way possible, dribbling up to shooters, standing in front of them and handing them the ball so they could shoot over him so that people couldn't get... I mean, it was a riot watching him go after that assist record. But Rondo has been pissing me off on defense for a while now. And I know you talk about how he's always out there directing people, making sure they're on the right guys and stuff like that. But I'm starting to feel like Rondo, in a lot of situations, for as far as help defense or coming over and helping out off of his guy, he's about as effective as Eric Gordon was at it. So tell me why I'm wrong, because it's starting to annoy me.
No, you're not. I mean, every guy, especially a guy who signs a one-year deal for $3 million, is going to have a weakness. You're not getting many perfect players in the league, and you're definitely not getting one at that contract. That's his huge weakness. He really can't get through picks. He can't fight anybody on switches. When he's on rotations, we're a little spoiled by Drew Holiday, who's going to give it his all against a power forward if he gets stuck down there with him. Rondo's basically going to do nothing, let the guy score, and then have somebody else take it out of the basket and give it to him and push him up the court. That is definitely a weakness of his. And defensively, it's not a strength. And then the other part that makes it a little harder is, okay, well, Rondo's not giving you what you need. Who are we going to put in? Jameer Nelson, who might be just as bad defensively, but doesn't give you the playmaking offensively and isn't hitting your shots. And this is why I say I've done a kind of 180 on this. I was all about getting another five for this team if the Pelicans were to make a move. To me, I see a nice seven-man rotation once Hill gets back for the playoffs. I need one more guy, and I think that guy has to be – he doesn't have to be a point guard necessarily, but he needs to be a bigger, longer guy who can handle, who can play the quote-unquote point guard position, because Nelson and Rondo, teams are just going to take advantage of the – in a seven-game series – a team's going to know every one of your weaknesses. And if you get Rondo or Nelson to switch onto a bigger guy, or you get them rotating and having to be down low, it's an automatic 2 points. So I fully agree with you there.
Oh, I expected a little resistance.
No, I mean, there's no way that you're going to get a guy for 1 year, $3 million, that's going to be good at everything. Now, right. on the flip side, in the month of December, Rondo shooting 50% from the field, 40 from three, 8 points and 10 assists in about 26 minutes a game. So, the offensive rating when he's on the floor, 121. So, I mean, he's given you what he's going to give you, but yeah, I mean, he's a clear weakness on the other end.
So, Since this is January 1st, we've now seen a couple months of basketball. I want you to come up with two things, and I'm ambushing you on this, so everybody expect some hemming and hawing as things about this. Two things that you didn't expect from this team that we're seeing from them now. And it could be good, could be bad, whatever. Just two things you didn't expect, and here we are on January 1st, and you're like, wow, that's weird.
I didn't expect Ian Clark to be a non-rotation piece. I would have guessed that he would have been in the rotation every night because he does the smart thing. He plays defense. He obviously knows a lot of what Gentry wants to do and fits that role. And then, but I guess going hand in hand with that, the other thing I didn't expect was this Etuan Moore. Like this Etuan Moore, I wouldn't even know how to classify it. Like there's no way it could sustain. There's no way. But then part of me also, you know, every game it seems like I look up and he's 6 of 9 and then he's 3 of 4 from three and he's just playing solid. He's added this little, you know, this little mid range and this little floater to his game where he, you know, if guys run out on him, he's able to get to the basket and score within 6 feet with these little floaters. And I remember on the podcast last year saying that I think that Etuan Moore will be the most improved Pelican next year, but even I didn't expect that. I mean, the guy is shooting nearly 60% from two, 47 from three, just super efficient. And I would have never, if you would have like shown me these basketball reference, stats before the season, I would have been like, good God, the Pelicans must be 15 games over 500. I can't believe what they're getting from him specifically.
Yeah. I mean, so he was one of my two, and it wasn't just even that. Like, think back the last 3 years, even including last year when Moore was here. If there was a two-on-two fast break, did you feel comfortable at all that our team was scoring in that situation?
No, I was just hoping that it wouldn't be a turnover.
Right. Like, Eric Gordon, Tyreke Evans, Drew Holiday... Like, everybody on our team in those two-on-two or one-on-one or even two-on-three, if you have them at a disadvantage and you're going to make a break anyways, it always felt like it was a disaster waiting to happen. It felt like they were going to turn the ball over all the time or they were going to miss a stupid layup. And Etuan Moore, despite extremely limited athleticism, might be one of the most intelligent finishers around the rim and short of the rim I've seen as a guard in a long time. He doesn't have that many physical tools compared to a lot of the other guys, but he's got floaters. He knows how to muscle a guy off. He knows how to take a little extra step and bump a guy and then finish with a layup. Like, he's just got a lot of little moves, and you don't see him get blocked that often. He's really good at it. And that's pretty shocking to me. The other thing is, as much as I trashed Dante Cunningham for the past, like, 3 years, I didn't think he'd be this much garbage. Like, every time he gets on the floor, like, it used to be Dante Cunningham would get on the floor. I'd be like, all right, well, we need to spell somebody for some minutes. He's getting a minimum contract. Let him sit up there and play. Great, fine. And now every time Dante Cunningham comes on the floor, I'm like, God, please get him off and get Darius Miller in there. Like, Michael Beasley tore his ass apart in that New York game. Just left and right. It was ridiculous. And it wasn't like Beasley was jab-stepping, bumping into him, and then hitting a fadeaway. He was just taking him to the rack and scoring on him over and over. And it's just, he is so bad. So bad!
So is it mostly just the defensive end you're talking about?
Cunningham's just...
ball or everything?
Cunningham has one talent this year, and that is being in the dunker spot and being able to sometimes grab an offensive rebound out of it or, you know, catch and finish. He runs a little bit too. That's it. Like, he can't hit a shot. He can't pass the ball. He can't dribble. He can't defend. He can't rebound anything most of the time. It's really bad. Really bad.
Yeah, I can't see unless Hill stays injured or Miller gets hurt. I don't see him in this team's playoff rotation. But, you know, even when Hill comes back, it's going to be most likely between Cunningham and Oshik for 8 to 12 minutes a game that you're going to need at a third big, and I think he's going to win out. But, yeah, I am looking forward to when he is not in the playoff rotation whatsoever.
Yeah.
That said, he is posting his career best in turnover percentage this year and is actually leading the league in turnover percentage in a good way. So,
nobody on the Pelicans will throw him the ball.
Well, I mean, turnover percentage, he needs to have the ball to keep it low. So it's actually that he's probably not passing it or doing anything with it once he gets it.
As soon as he catches it, he shoots it.
Shoots it or, yeah, dribble handoff something. But, yeah, I'm looking forward to him getting out of the rotation. That said, I mean, let's try to imagine we were doing this pod before the Dallas and New York games, because I'm sure we would be more optimistic. We wouldn't have, you know, the recency bias of the negative things. So try if you can to slip back to those three games. Were the Pelicans just playing inferior opponents, or did you feel like they really were starting to do something different and better? And if they can get back to that, is there reasons for optimism, or are they just a 500 team that were playing bad teams on that night?
So I think that they showed in those games that they were going to execute really well against teams. Like, this is the thing that the Spurs always get mad credit for offensively, is that they run their stuff for the whole game, and the Pelicans have shown that they can do it for three quarters and be pretty effective at it. And if they're running their game, it doesn't matter what the other team is doing. Doesn't matter how good or bad they are. They're going to score on them. They're going to get a little bit of an edge, and then they just have to take the fourth quarter and take it home all the way. Of those three teams, Orlando, Miami, and Brooklyn, I actually think that Miami was in this particular instance was clearly down so many players that I'm not taking a ton of excitement out of that win. But I mean, Orlando and Brooklyn, they worked those teams. They made them look bad, and they're not awful. They're not good, obviously, but they shouldn't be made to look awful, and that's what was happening in those games. It felt like there was nothing Orlando or Brooklyn were going to be able to do to stop the Pelicans scoring whenever they wanted to. And it felt the same in Miami. It's just when you look at Miami's roster, and that Dragic was just coming back that day, and he has a bad elbow, and he's playing through pain in the elbow, and Whiteside wasn't there, and there's a bunch of other people missing. Would you feel great about taking out the Pelicans last year when they were a mash unit at the beginning of the year? It's not really. So.
Yeah. No, I mainly just want to talk about the 3 minutes and 29 seconds we saw Charles Cook play. Shut up. No, I'm just kidding. I feel like, so some of these games going into, I knew the Pelicans were to win. To me, there's a certain type of team that, see, I don't think the Pelicans get beat much. I think they beat themselves. So when I want to see if I think they're going to win or lose a game, I look at specific things like, does this team crash the offensive glass? Does this team pressure you and turn you over? And I think they ran up against a couple of teams who don't really do either of those things. Specifically, I was looking at the New Jersey game, and New Jersey doesn't try to turn you over at all. And I knew they were just going to wash them. But, I think it was part matchup, but obviously they were playing well. I think, you know, we could see that Jrue Holiday isn't a fluke. And, almost every night you're going to get good games from more Holiday, Cousins, and Davis as far as scoring goes. So then, like, when you have a Miami game and then you have Ian Clark and Darius Miller bearing threes, now you're going to blow somebody out because you're always going to get, you know, in most cases, 80 to 90 points from those other four. So if you get 19 from Ian Clark, you're gold. So that's, I think part of it was matchups. The Wizards game was really weird. It was funny to hear David Wesley say in all of his years of playing and watching basketball, that was the weirdest game he had ever seen. I think he was overreacting a little bit, but to get that far down, to come all the way back and tie it, and then just get blown out again. I gotta agree. I don't think I've ever seen. I've seen a team come back from like 25, get within six, and then just burn out and wind up losing the game by 20. But I've never seen a team come all the way back and then within a matter of like 3.5 minutes have the lead be 18 again. But you know, that's what the Pelicans are here for, to show us things that we've never seen before.
So, do you think that they get cocky when they're feeling like things are rolling? Do you think like their mindset goes somewhere bad and they start making mistakes, and that's why they did the same thing with Dallas. They got back within three twice after that horrendous barrage, and then suddenly they're just like, oh, brain fart, we forgot how to play basketball. Like, Davis left him wide open in the Barea wide open in the corner by himself. So what do you think?
I think that these guys all have terrible habits from the past, and it's not that they're forgetting how to play basketball. It's that they didn't really know how to play, and when they're playing well, it's actually not their natural. And then when adversity hits, or when they get too far ahead and then the coach lets off the reins a little bit, or it comes down to the final couple minutes of the game, I think they just revert back to who they've been and who they are at their core. Like, there's no way you could tell me in that Knicks game that when it was tied with like 40 seconds left, the Gentry said, okay, Cousins, I want you to get the ball 19 feet out, hold it for 10 seconds. Then AD, I want you to come and demand the ball 16 feet from the hoop and shoot a fadeaway. Like, there's no way you can convince me the coaching staff told him to do that. But their adversity started to come. AD didn't trust the system, but he trusts himself to get a shot over the Knicks and win it. So he goes and he does some, you know, some garbage thing. And same with Boogie. It's like, that to me would be my guess, is they are who they are at their core. And then when certain things strike or when it gets too tense, they're not going to trust in the system. They're just going to go back to the bad habits that they've had for what, 5, 6, 7 years now.
Yeah. Second question for you.
Uh-oh.
A lot of this team relies on the three-point line now more than they ever have before, and it's clear they do. They run a lot of plays for it. They have guys who are willing to cast and encouraged to cast from that distance. Both the New York game and the Dallas game, the three-point line went dry. And, you know, you listen to the broadcast, and David Wesley, who grew up in an era where taking three three-pointers a game, you were pretty awesome as a three-point shooter in that situation. Like, you're taking a lot. You know, both of them will be saying stuff like, hey, stop taking so many threes, take the ball to the hole. Like, so where do you come down on that? If your team is building its offense around jacking and taking threes freely, and you're now sitting there and you're looking at the scoreboard and you're 4 of 16 from the field from 3 or 3 of 15 from 3, do you think you should stop taking them? Do you think you should run a slightly different offense? Should you emphasize going to the rim more? Or do you think you should just keep casting?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it all depends on the type of threes. Like, I love – go back to that Miami-San Antonio series. The second one, I still say, I've watched these Warriors, obviously, the last couple of years. I still say San Antonio in that series was the best offensive basketball I've ever seen in my life. And they were throwing up a lot of threes, but it's penetration, kick, swing, second penetration, kick to the corner, open three. And, like, that to me is fine. You know, Boogie trailing 5 seconds behind on the fast break, gets thrown the pass. The big man doesn't come out. He pump fakes. The big man still doesn't come up far enough. So now Boogie takes the three. Like, that's a totally different three than the ones I'm describing from the Spurs. So I don't think there's a right answer with take more threes, take less threes. I think that what you want to do as an offense is have a defense thinking and worrying about every possible thing. And that's just something that the Pelicans don't do, especially late in games. And, you know, I still think that a huge component of this team's offense should be the offensive rebound. But you can't just say, hey, big guys, go offensive rebound, because especially if we're jacking threes and one of our bigs is the one who's doing it, you know, that's not going to be an effective strategy. To me, the guards driving to the rim and missing the shot and get the Kobe or Tyreek Evans assist, like, that could be a very effective thing for this offense. And I know the numbers say that they're doing well, but just as a defense, I'm not having to worry about as many things as I should have to worry about with this level of skill set of offensive players. So, roundabout way, and I know there's no simple answer, and you probably wanted something shorter and quicker, but I don't mind the amount of threes. I mind probably 8 or 9 threes a game, the type of threes that they are.
Yeah. Okay. Boogie is taking less threes. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, but I mean,
He had one in Dallas. He started casting again, but I think before that, you know, over the last like 8 or 9 games, he'd only averaged about 4, 4.5.
Right, but we're also starting to see both guys' free throws go down, you know, a little bit. I mean, Davis to me should be, we saw games where he shot 17 and 19, you know, he should be over 10, and now he's down to, you know, right around 8 a game. Boogie's still get, I mean, they're both combining for 16 a game. That's fine, but I don't know why this team isn't in the penalty more, isn't shooting more free throws, and isn't getting more offensive rebounds. Like, there's no way that this team should be 25th in the league in offensive rebound percentage and only average when it comes to free throws, when you should have two guys who are getting 20 a game by themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, so I have a theory about Davis. I think his groin is still bothering him. Like, I feel like his explosion has been coming back over the last few games, but it didn't feel like he was that mobile up until, you know, probably like, you know, 3 games ago, 4 games ago. And yeah, I mean, he's still not getting a ton of free throws in the last couple games either. But it didn't feel like he was exploding as much, and I think that groin injury was still bothering him as much as they basically tried to ignore the fact that it was there. Do you think that's me just, you know, coming up with an excuse, or did you feel that way too about him?
Yeah, I think he's banged up. I mean, you see him wincing and something wrong every game, it seems like. So he's not 100%, but really nobody is right now. I still think that this team settles far too often. I mean, again, if I'm an opposing team, I'm terrified of all the things that these two bigs could do, and nothing makes me happier than them shooting fadeaway 18-footers or, you know, three-pointers out of rhythm. So I guess I always think of it like that, like, if I'm the opposing team, what am I terrified of? And I just don't think, you know, our two bigs and just our team in general does enough of those things. Now, luckily, they are, well, not luckily, it's probably skill, but they are, the Pelicans are hitting a high percentage of shots from everywhere on the court, and maybe that continues, but if they just revert to the mean or just become average from two and three, and they, you know, all the turnovers keep up, and then the lack of free throws, like, this is going to be an average to below average offense, and when you combine it with how terrible the defense is, like, things could get even worse. So I still don't love the types of shots that they're getting, but I am happy that they're hitting them.
Honestly, I think you're a little nuts there. I really like some of their offense. Like, the amount of cutting I see per game and the open looks that they generate on the perimeter, I think that they've been pretty successful at doing that. And yes, I think you could probably come up with better ways to use Davis and Cousins in ways that would be devastating. But I think their offense generates the kind of shots we want them to be taking. So,
do you think if Rondo goes down for 3 weeks, do you think this will still be a good offense?
Yeah.
Okay.
It won't be great, but it'll be good.
Yeah.
Do you believe? Can you believe? Like, so this is just something about how jaded I am because we watch Anthony Davis for years and years, and he puts up incredible stat lines, and we never talk about them. Realize in the last five games, Boogie Cousins put up a 26-14-6-2-2 with 3.5 turnovers per game. Like, that stat line is obscene.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely could put up some stats.
You're such a dick.
No, I mean, me, a lot of guys on this team, I mean, I don't know how many posts I've seen from Pelicans PR about how Drew did this and this in the month of December and no other person has done. That's great. Like, according to the stats, the Pelicans have, like, what, three of the top 12 offensive players in the month of December? Like, seriously. Can you name 10 players who have been better offensively than either AD, Cousins, or Drew?
Like, you're asking seriously if I can name 10 others?
In the month of December, I bet you $1 million there weren't 10 offensive players better than any of those guys. Like, Harden obviously was, Westbrook obviously was, LeBron, you know, one or two Warriors. I guarantee
Durant,
Giannis. But I look at the stats for those three guys in December. Like, they were all world in the month of December. And yet, what was their record? Pretty much 500. So, yeah, that's great. Everybody could put up stats. You're telling me you have confidence in this team? You know, 97-97, 3 minutes left to go against any team average or better. You have confidence in this team with supposedly three of the top 10 to 15 offensive weapons in the NBA. You feel good about your chances. And I haven't even told you the team, but as long as they're not a doormat, you would feel good about the Pelicans getting that win.
No, I feel about average. They're terrible offensively. They're awful.
When it counts, they are.
All season long, they've been awful. It's not even when it counts. They've just been terrible. And, yeah, a lot of it's generated off the turnovers, and we can say, oh, they cut the turnovers, they'll be fine. But they're bad. I'm sorry.
On defense, yeah. I'm saying on offense, when the game actually counts, all these stat monsters that it really don't matter. I don't believe in this team's offense in a close late game late. Even with these three just guys playing out of their head and Etwan Moore being one of the most efficient guards in the NBA, I still don't – like, what's their identity? What are they going to do for those last seven possessions? What's going to be the bread and butter? And then when a team goes to stop that, what's their secondary? Like, what do you think the plan even is? Because I could see this team front run – and this team did a great job of blowing out three bad teams. That's great. I can't remember the last time this team got in a really close game and they just executed fantastically down the stretch. Maybe the Milwaukee game? They stopped turning
it over. Yeah, Milwaukee, I think, was the last one.
Yeah, and they stopped turning it over, had a couple nice possessions. I still think there has to be something on that end where I would love to ask that question. 3 minutes left, tied game. You're going to get seven more possessions. What is your bread and butter going to be? What are you going to do on those seven possessions? And then we'll worry about defense. But I honestly think the offense is something you got to worry about right now in those situations.
Okay. All right. So, guys, any more to talk about the games, or shall we talk about the games that are coming up?
I'd say the ones that are coming up, unless you have anything. And the only other thing I have is I know I applauded him at the beginning, and I do think he kept us afloat before Rondo got back. Do you think that Jameer Nelson is just going through a stretch, or are we starting to see the beginning of – yeah, Jameer probably shouldn't be a constant rotation player, and we're going to have to look for something else there.
I think it's that the second thing you said. So, like, I think Jameer is not physically capable of playing at a high level night in and night out. And I think he's the kind of guy who can come in and give you, like, 15 minutes in a game if he's had a lot of rest for a week and be pretty impressive, which we saw. But, yeah, I mean, he's looked pretty bad at times.
Do you think that Ian Clark gets that shot?
I think we already see Ian Clark's been getting minutes here and there. I think they're trying.
Yeah, he's coming back. Do you – and then Tony Allen might come back at some point. I'm just trying to figure out if no moves are made, what this guard rotation is going to be looking like going forward. I mean, do you, I don't know. I don't know what to do, but I mean, the bench is something we haven't talked about. And in the last two games, they just got obliterated. The bench has given you nothing, on either end of the court.
Miller.
Yeah. I mean, Miller's given you something, but, Jameer's given you nothing. And Cunningham's, if they're giving you nothing on offense, you're screwed because you know they're not giving you anything on defense. This bench, I guess Hill could come back and maybe Moore could be your sixth man. Miller, I think, is fine for a seventh, but I'm just curious what you're thinking about long term as far as eighth, ninth in the rotation and how this is going to play out.
So my plan, if I were the Pelicans front office, is I would talk to Gentry and say, give Clark 10, 15 games to see if he can prove that he can take those backup minutes and play well or not. And I think I've seen flashes that he could. Like he makes pretty good decisions. So see if you can get him comfortable in that role and see if you can do that. If he can do that, I try to see if I can land at the deadline some sort of backup big, and if he can't, I go find a backup point guard as best I can.
Okay. Yeah,
I gotta tell you, the idea of Mirotić really gets me rolling.
Yeah. I wish that move would have been made a couple of weeks ago. Now I think the Bulls would hold out for Anthony Davis at this point. I mean, Mirotić is the. Why do you trade him if you're Chicago? Guy looks like a freaking golden god. To me, and obviously Mirotić is good, but to me, this team needs another creator. Like, they're back in the playoff hunt now, but imagine if they had totally tanked, like a guy like Lou Williams coming off this bench would just, I mean, that would be fantastic.
They tried to get Nick Young. They tried.
Yeah. A guy like
Jordan Crawford?
No. out in Brooklyn, Spencer Dinwiddie, you know, somebody like that, somebody who's a little bigger. I mean, honestly, a guy who would be a nice fit, and it's still the trade that I feel like does the most for the Pelicans, but Marco Bellinelli. Because Bellinelli can be your quote-unquote point guard of a second unit that has Boogie and, let's say, an Etuan Moore or Solomon Hill, like has enough guys who could dribble the ball. And then, yeah, he's not a great defender, but he's bigger than Nelson. And, you know, he's just as smart, and at least he'll provide a little bit more resistance. But to me, that Bellinelli Deadman for, you know, Ashik Ejinsa in a first trade just still makes so much sense for this team and would really plug up multiple areas. So that's still the one I'm kind of hoping for.
Yep. Okay. There's only two games before our next podcast.
Right.
That's at Utah and at Minnesota. Two teams that are competing in the West. Utah trying to get back into the picture, and Minnesota trying to stay up near the top of the seeding rather than fall down near the bottom. So which one are you going to talk about first? You're going to be at the Utah game, right? So let's talk about that, because I'm sure you're excited.
Yeah, I mean, Utah is a team that they play well at home. They just beat Cleveland. It's a good crowd. They don't have Gobert, who I still say, for my money, is the guy that gives Cousins more problems than anybody else in the league. And really, their offense is going to go as Mitchell and Hood go. Mitchell just absolutely tore the Pelicans apart last time, mostly in that fourth quarter where they just kept putting him and whoever Cousins was covering in a pick and roll. Cousins didn't know whether to come up and then get blown by or back up, and then Mitchell would hit a three. So there was really no solution for that play, and the Jazz just ran it over and over and over again in the fourth quarter. Obviously, AD was stopping it in the first three, but of course the Pelicans go up 18. And then Anthony Davis gets hurt and leaves that game and misses the rest of it. So that's just Pelicans pelicaning. But yeah, that was really it. And then in that last game, Alec Burks was a god as well. His minutes have decreased a little bit lately with Joe Johnson coming back. So they have a couple perimeter guys, but they have absolutely nothing that could stop. I mean, they're playing Ingles at the four lately. They got Derek Favors at the five. They got Ekpe Udo as the backup for both of those spots. I mean, Davis and Boogie should eat. Everybody else should be able to get into the paint against this Jazz team. And then on the other end, it's just going to be about slowing Mitchell and hoping that Rodney Hood doesn't have one of his, you know, random 37-point games.
So let me ask you a question. Feet to the fire, both teams completely healthy. I mean, completely healthy. Solomon Hill, Rudy Gobert, everybody's back. One game, your life is dependent on it. Are you taking the Jazz and neutral site, so not even Jazz home court or whatever, neutral site? Do you think the Jazz are a better team or the Pelicans are a better team?
I think that the Pelicans are a better team. I think the Jazz would win. The Pelicans have more talent. The Jazz would win. I think they would do so many things, especially with Gobert, to frustrate Cousins. The Jazz already cause a lot of turnovers. I think Boogie would have 14 turnovers in that game if he didn't foul out first. I think that I would take the Jazz if my life depended on it in that scenario. I just think they play harder. I think they care more. I think that they're better coached. Like, they have all the intangibles. Teague as well. So I think it'll be a similar situation as when these two teams played. And the Wolves will just be absolutely exhausted, and I think the Pels have to take advantage of that. Butler's going to get his points, but I really think that they could slow down everybody else. The two guys who I actually worry about in this game, and this goes back to the Pelicans bench, but if you were to tell me what Jamal Crawford and what you always pronounce this name way better than I do, which is a first, but
Bielitsa.
You tell me what those two do. Basically, those two are going to be the key to the game. The Pelicans just can't let the Minnesota bench dominate them again. That's, to me, that's really been the difference in the first two games. So I think they play them at the right time. There'll be no excuse there. If they could just at least play the bench to even, I think the Pelicans come out of there with a win as well.
So did you realize that Minnesota and New Orleans are 24 and 25 ranked defensively and 4 and 6 ranked offensively?
Yeah, like, I mean, I watch Minnesota play a lot, and they're the same as the Pels. They just find a way to lose the game. I mean, there's no way. It's so frustrating. The Pelicans should have the fourth best record in the West right now, fifth or sixth. But Minnesota's just finding a way.
The major difference is, even though Minnesota's fourth and the Pelicans are sixth, and usually there's not a big difference between those two teams, there's actually, in this case, a 2.4. So now, let's actually talk about Star Wars. And I'll let you talk, because on Twitter, you don't seem very pleased with...
Will I watch it? And I guarantee there will be no reason to, because I'll think of 7 as the one that started everything, 9 as everything that resolved it, and 8 having absolutely no purpose, no really memorable scenes or scenes that, you know, really told a huge part of the story that I need to see. And it all sums up with the whole Finn Rose, you know, 30-minute sidetrack on this mission that when you stand back, you go, there was absolutely 0 point to that mission. All Laura Dern's character, I never remember her name, has to do is tell Poe, yeah, basically we're stalling and we're going to go over to this planet over. But instead, well, we need something to do with all of these characters, so we're going to have this whole side story that takes up 30 to 40 minutes of the film. And in the grand scheme of things, it means absolutely nothing. And the only purpose of it is we're going to try to fool the audience, because there's no reason that Laura Dern's character doesn't just tell everybody on the ship, hey, here's the plan, we're stalling. The only reason she doesn't is to trick us, the movie audience, into thinking maybe she's a villain or maybe she is a coward or whatever, and now we got to send these other characters off on this completely pointless mission and this Casino Royale crap. So that's my little rant. It just feels like a placeholder for part 9, and I can't imagine ever watching this one again once the full trilogy is put out there.
Okay. And you're probably going to be surprised by this, but I would probably rank it as probably the second worst one in the entire series so far. I really am not a fan of the prequel number 2. It was Attack of the Clones, I believe it's called. So what you just described makes perfect sense to me if you know anything about what happened after the first movie. Like, the entire, about how you're saying it feels like that story with Poe is kind of tacked on. Apparently Poe came out of that first movie and everybody loved Poe and they decided they wanted to make Poe more of an actual character in the series. So they went back and they rewrote part of it to make him a bigger character. Which tells me they had like a plot and a plan and then decided to make it bigger, and like you can't really fit him into either of the stories that they already had written. So, and honestly, what is the point of Benicio del Toro in that entire movie? What did he do that mattered even a little bit? Like, how does any of it make sense? I can't figure it out. Like, so he can say, oh, hey, they have ships escaping. Like, they could have figured that out 87 different ways. That whole scene is just, you're right, it's absolutely ridiculous. But that's not even my biggest problem with the film. It feels to me like both the first film and the second film, and I actually liked, you know, Force Awakens. I thought there's a lot of parts of it that were a lot of fun. It feels like they've done too much of an ode to the old characters. Like, the first movie was an ode to Han Solo, and spoilers, he's dead. Anyone who didn't know that, too bad. So the first movie was basically a extended goodbye to Han Solo, and now the second movie's been an extended goodbye to Luke, and they've thrown in some pieces there very clearly afterwards and after editing to add a little bit of goodbye to Leia as well. And you know what? I don't need that. I don't give a crap. Like, I like those characters, but bring me to an actual story, not a goodbye. I want an actual plot that makes the main characters much more important than they are. And the only scene in the entire movie where I was like, all right, this is awesome, I'm enjoying the hell out of this, is the one in the throne room with Rey and Kylo Ren and Snoke. That's it. Like, the whole scene at the end where they're fighting and where there's the whole blasting away at Luke in front of the base, this, and them trying to attack the walkers head on. Like, how many times are these people going to be so stupid that they're like, I see a giant tank pointing its guns at me. Charge! Like, figure something else out. Come in from the flank. They don't seem to be very able to, like, how long would it take for one of those walkers to turn? Let's fly around it and come in from the back. Like, yeah. How could you be so damn stupid? So I really did enjoy the scene in the throne room. I thought that was well done. I thought there was exciting parts. I'm not sure why all of those guards became ninjas, but I still enjoyed it. So, I don't know. I have to throw it down there at the bottom. Like, the only thing that in all of the Star Wars movies I feel that makes that qualifies as worse than this is the inexplicable love between Natalie Portman's character and whiny bitch face Anakin. Like, those guys that they had no chemistry and no reason why they would even like each other. Well, I know why Anakin would like her, but I don't know why she would ever like him. So that's my take on this movie. I'm sorry if everybody was looking forward to it. I thought it was kind of disappointing and long.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was looking forward to it, and I agree. If it is on cable and it's near the Snoke throne room scene, I'll watch that. But it's honestly because Snoke, I felt, was in the very brief time one of my favorite characters. Like, people will say he was just pure evil, but he had some charisma. He had, like, some sarcasm. He was kind of a dick, like, in a, you know, in a sarcastic way, not just pure evil like the Emperor. I really enjoyed Snoke, and then of course he's gone before we know anything about him. But I also thought it was very inauthentic to who Luke Skywalker was. Like, if you really try to show me those, you know, 20 years of what happened between the last time we saw him and then what we saw him now, like, to me, if it wouldn't have been the same actor or same name, like, you can't tell me that that person is the same character and has the, you know, similar characteristics, like this hopeful kid, and then all of a sudden, you know, he sees what might be a little bit of bad in Kylo and he thinks about killing him, where, you know, with Darth Vader, he gave him every benefit of the doubt ever. There's just a lot of things with that. And the attempts at the humor, it just, like, I was unfortunate. I, you know, when you go to the theater and you have, like, the ultra nerd in the theater who, like, laughs at all the corniest shit. I of course sat right next to that guy. So not only was the humor not working on me, but it was like a double-edged because I was also sitting next to, you know, ultra nerd who, you know, makes it a point to let everybody know that he gets the joke as if it's so inside and nobody else gets it. No, we're just not laughing because it's corny and, you know, a Star Wars movie isn't supposed to be slapstick, but anyway, so yeah,
That's not true though. Go back and watch the original three movies, and C-3PO and R2-D2 and Chewie are all there for comic relief. That is their prime and only purpose in those movies.
But, yeah,
except for R2-D2 being cool every once in a while.
It's not super corny. It's like the funniest line in any of the Star Wars is the "I love you, I know." Like, just a wise ass, like, that's like more adult humor. And then, yeah, C-3PO, which was always my least favorite part of the original three, he's got a little bit of that corny humor. But the, like, this one, like, honestly, I'm a big Jade Silent Bob Strike Back fan. I really felt like Kevin Smith wrote parts of it. Like, there was just so, like, I almost expected Luke to look at the camera when he threw the lightsaber over his and just kind of shrug. And, like, it was just a different brand of humor that I was not into. But, yeah, I'm still looking forward to the ninth one, but almost more because I just want it, you know, to resolve. Because I really like 7 a lot. I would say Rogue One is probably my favorite of all of them. So I was really excited about this one. I think 8-10 years from now will be something that we don't even think about, except aside from maybe that throne room scene will be fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, if you think back at the other movies, most of what you want to go look for is, you know, there's some moments in Empire Strikes Back you're going to go watch just because it's kind of cool overall. And even some in Return of the Jedi, but, you know, the only reason to watch any of the first three movies are mostly the fight scenes. And there was nothing...
Leia in a bikini.
I forgot about that. And honestly, that was probably the best moment of Attack of the Clones, is how that creature attacked Natalie Portman and artfully removed her clothes across the midriff. That was awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyways. Yeah, so, like, I'm kind of bummed I'm so down on it. My family actually really liked it, and I've been very careful not to, like, try to trash it, because I like to... So this is cathartic for me, being able to talk about it.
And if you want more uplifting, apparently Jake Madison liked it. He's got his own podcast. Hopefully he'll talk about it. Again, I agree. Some of the things they were trying to do were unique. I like some of the philosophies of the fact that, you know, good or whatever could come out of nowhere. It doesn't have to necessarily be lineage, and only these people have the ability to have the force and shape the universe. I like that. I like the idea of the one thing I did like about Benicio del Toro's character is this idea of, you know, where everybody's talking about good and bad, and he's kind of like, no, these guys will blow this up today, they'll win today, they'll win tomorrow, you know, it'll just keep going back and forth, it's all kind of pointless, I'm just going to try to, you know, get the most I can out of, like, I like some of the concepts, I just don't like, when a movie tries to trick me. And that in the universe of itself, if it wasn't a movie, it doesn't make any sense. And then I don't like when a movie stalls. Like, my time's pretty precious. I don't need you to stall. If you don't have anything else to say in this story, then just make it shorter and put it all in part 9. But those were the two things it did that I was just frustrated by. That said, I'm still looking forward to 9, and I'm still looking forward to the Han Solo movie with Donald Glover as Lando.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Because that one, they had to get rid of the director and bring in a whole new one to fix it. So
yeah,
I'm worried about that one.
I can't remember the last thing I saw with Donald Glover that I didn't enjoy. So maybe if it's just his part, I'll like.
That's true. I did see one movie recently I really did like. So I mean, it's stupid. Funny, but Thor it's not at all like the previous Thors, which were kind of heavy and I am Thor. This one was a very clear effort to make it funny and lighthearted and completely silly, and I bought it and loved it, so it's great.
My movie recommendation overall is to watch Black Mirror. If you haven't watched the first three seasons on Netflix, get on that and then watch season four. But my favorite movie of the last couple of weeks was actually Lady Bird. And no, it's not about Lyndon Johnson's wife, though I do think there were quite a few moviegoers. There was like this front section of like six people who were all 90 years old or older, and I am pretty sure they thought it was about Lyndon B. Johnson's wife, and then they wound up being susceptible to a 17-year-old girl having sex with a gay male, so probably not what they signed up for.
Probably not. All right, thanks everybody for listening.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.